headlines, the Yemeni army conducts two drone attacks on Saudi Arabia a day after striking an Aramco facility in Jeddah with a missile. China says it will confront any foreign interference in Hong Kong and deter any separatist activity in Taiwan. Also ahead, the US Capitol Police demand that National Guard troops remain at the Capitol amid warnings of a possible attack there. Welcome to World News, it's good to have you with us. Our top story, the Yemeni army says it has carried out retaliatory drone strikes against targets at Saudi Arabia's King Khalid Air Base and Abha International Airport. Yemeni army spokesman Yahya Sari said the attacks conducted by Samad 3 and the Qasif 2K drones were in response to Saudi Arabia's escalation of aggression and continued siege of Yemen. The strikes came a day after a similar attack on the King Khalid Air Base. Also on Thursday, the Yemeni army launched a missile attack against an Aramco oil facility in Saudi Arabia. Our correspondent in Sana'a, the Yemeni capital, Abdul Latif Washali, says Yemen will continue its attacks on Saudi positions in response to the kingdom's war on the country.
The Yemeni army have warned earlier that it will continue escalating its attacks, retaliatory attacks against Saudi Arabia, and they will maybe in the next days will be much harder for Saudi Arabia due to the continued detention of oil vessels. Yemenis have a severe fuel crisis since the beginning of 2021. Not even a liter of oil derivatives was allowed to enter the country. So the equation, I think, will be their oil in exchange of the Yemenis' oil. The Yemeni army will continue its escalation on the ground. It will continue advancing toward Marib. I think the battle fronts in Marib are also another pressure in the Saudi Arabia. So the Yemeni army will continue its attacks, whether they were on the Saudi facilities or on the ground.
Meanwhile, a mortar attack by Saudi-backed mercenaries has killed two infants in Yemen's Taiz province. Several people were also injured in the attack that hit a residential area. Loyalists of Saudi-backed former Yemeni regime often conduct attacks on areas under the control of the Ansar Allah movement and its allies. Such attacks have taken place amid Saudi Arabia's war on Yemen. Riyadh began its war with the stated goal of toppling Ansar Allah. On the ground, however, civilians have borne the brunt of the conflict. The United Nations says nearly 250,000 Yemenis have died so far, more than half of them from indirect causes such as a lack of food. Israel's Minister of Military Affairs says Tel Aviv is updating its plans for striking Iranian nuclear sites.
Recently, the Chief of Staff, Aviv Kohavi, said that Israel is preparing to strike Iranian nuclear targets if needed. Are those preparations complete?
They will never complete. Before the only time of completing them will be the time that we will actually conduct them. Till then, we will continue to build them, to improve them. This is something that any military needs to do. We are working on it. We have them in our hands, of course, but we will continue and constantly improving them to the highest professional level possible. But it's very important to remember what you have just said, Ray.
Gantz told Fox News that Israel has identified numerous targets inside Iran. He expressed hope that the world would stop what he called Iran's nuclear aspirations. Gantz added, if that does not happen, Israel would be ready to act independently. Iranian authorities have time and again warned of a decisive response to any possible attack by Israel. They maintain that Iran's nuclear program is peaceful and is under rigorous international inspection. That is while Israel is believed to have hundreds of nuclear warheads and does not allow inspection of its sites. John Stepling is an author and commentator and joins us now. John, welcome. So the irony here, of course, is that Iran has a peaceful nuclear program, according to intelligence agencies across the world, including the intelligence of the Israeli regime, whereby Israel has hundreds of nuclear warheads. And most likely most of them directed at Iran.
Well, this is, you know, the Israeli nuclear capability is something that's been known for decades and decades, and they barely deny the fact anymore. It's such a well-known reality. And, of course, they are signatory to absolutely nothing. And yet they make these bellicose demands directed at Iran. And look, if, you know, we know that Israel assassinated various Iranian nuclear scientists. The United States assassinated General Soleimani. These are the rogue states. These are the countries that are in violation of all international law. Of course, under Obama, the U.S. even assassinated one of its own citizens. So you know, the ironies are multiple and many layered. It's exhausting almost to count them. But you know, Israel has always taken this very belligerent and the kind of arrogant stance that they are beyond the law. And you look at their treatment of the Palestinians, which is, you know, the world's number one human rights violation. There's an outdoor prison that they keep Palestinians in. And the IDF is, for all intents and purposes, a settler militia now. And the settlers are as fanatical and insane as any right-wing religious cult in the world. And yet, you know, Western press continues to treat Israel as if it's you know, a benign, peace-loving nation that is, you know, surrounded by enemies and so forth. Iran has adhered to every agreement. They have met every demand from you know, nuclear inspections to everything else. They have agreed to sit down again with the JCPOA if the U.S. you know, will adhere to the original terms of it. It was the U.S. that tore up the JCPOA, of course, as everybody knows. And Biden is going to be a very hawkish president, and this factors into things. He is already bombing in Syria. He has moved troops over there. They are most certainly going to try foment some kind of coup and get rid of Assad, who has been an embarrassment to the U.S. because they have wanted him gone for 30 years now. And the Syrians have fought very courageously against that. So
right.
U.S. foreign policy is a bit of a mess, but the U.S. protects Israel in these things. And you saw that interview was on Fox News, an American news station. That's what the American public hears. And it's always an uphill battle to get people to recognize the reality and not the propaganda.
Right. And John, finally, over the decades, Iran has supported many oppressed countries and people against tyrants and dictatorships. And now those same countries and resistance movements are much more powerful. So should Israel decide to ever go down this military route, will those same people that Iran supported over the decades join the Islamic Republic in its response to Israel and its allies, for that matter?
Well, I think many will, and I think that it's the thing one has to bear in mind is that, you know, Israel is a kind of U.S. welfare state. It has no tax base that could support its military or anything else, or its infrastructure even. They couldn't exist for a year without U.S., you know, the U.S. billions that are thrown at them and the billions from private donations that go into Israel. So they are kind of, as they have always been, an artificial settler state. And that begs the question of, you know, of history and their right to exist and all of that. But I mean, the fact is they're there. And they are a U.S. protectorate, and in some ways, of course, so is Saudi Arabia in an entirely different sense. But yeah, I mean, Israel is hated in the Arab world with good reason. Certainly, most people around the world are waking up to the human rights violation and the crimes of the Israeli state against the Palestinians. I think that they are aware of that, and they may saber rattle and talk tough, but I think they would certainly be ill advised to, and I think they know this, to launch a direct assault at this point.
Okay, John, thank you very much indeed for that. John Stepling there, author and commentator. Now moving on, a coalition of human rights groups has urged the United States to address what they call a dramatic deterioration in Bahrain's rights record. 15 groups, including Amnesty International and the Bahrain Institute for Rights and Democracy, made the call in a letter to the U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken. They said Bahrain, emboldened by former U.S. President Donald Trump's disregard for human rights, has intensified the crackdown on dissent to an unprecedented level. Manama has responded to a popular uprising that began in 2011 with an iron fist. The Al Khalifa regime has detained rights campaigners, broken up major opposition political parties, and revoked the nationality of several pro-democracy activists. The regime has also arrested, injured, and killed thousands of people. Rights activist Firas Najm says things have only become worse for the Bahraini people during the years as the Al Khalifa regime ruthlessly crushes dissidents.
Pretty much now they feel like they're successful because the people there are not really rising up anymore that much, and the movement hasn't reignited again, because I guess the people don't want their family members to be attacked, because we've seen the Bahraini regime has no mercy. They attack women, they rape women, they attack kids, they go in houses at nighttime and they hit with tear gas and the automatic weapons. They have mercenaries from different countries that are hired, that are given citizenships as well. I mean, so I don't see any positive changes from the Bahraini regime at all. I mean, the people are more quiet, not because they don't want to stand up. It's just because they are trying to keep their families out of the suffering and misery. And that's the reason. The Bahrainis, they want change still. They haven't gave up, and they're not submissive as well. That inside of them, they are just really wounded, and they want to do something, but they're trying to wait for the right time maybe to reignite, and hopefully that will happen if nothing is done by human rights organizations, the United Nations, and all these international key players.
China says it will resolutely guard against and deter any interference by external forces in Hong Kong's affairs. Prime Minister Li Keqiang made the remark at the annual session of the National People's Congress. Li said China will implement law and enforce mechanisms for Hong Kong to ensure national security. The Premier, at the same time, reaffirmed Beijing's commitment to fully support the One Country, Two Systems policy towards Hong Kong. On Taiwan, the Chinese Prime Minister said his country will resolutely deter any separatist activity aimed at independence. Li also said Beijing wants to promote peaceful ties with the island, but only under its One China principle. The policy asserts that Taiwan is part of mainland China. Stephen Rebay in Beijing says China believes that Hong Kong has become a base of subversion supported by foreign forces.
From China's point of view, Hong Kong had become a base of subversion to central power, and a lot of that subversion was being assisted and aided by foreign powers. Well, there's only one that really matters, and that's the United States. So China has moved over the past year to really stop that. Last year it passed the National Security Law, which made it illegal to collude with foreign powers or engage in subversive activities or what it terms as terrorist, which could be interpreted as any kind of violent or even too agitated demonstration. And now it's moving further to reform Hong Kong's electoral system.
The U.S. Capitol Police have demanded that National Guard troops remain at the Capitol amid warnings of a possible attack there. The department's acting chief made the appeal in a letter to congressional leaders. Yogananda Pittman called on them to use their influence to keep the guardsmen at the Capitol. She said the board that oversees her department has declined to extend an emergency declaration to keep the guardsmen. She said the board has instead sent her a list of actions, including partial removal of guarding fences. The U.S. Capitol is on high alert over warnings of a possible attack by a militia group that supports a former President Donald Trump in early January. Trump supporters stormed the building, leaving 5 people dead. Staying in the United States, where resentment is rising after President Joe Biden backtracked on his promise to raise the minimum wage to $15 per hour. However, study shows that considering the constant inflation in the country, even $15 per hour would not constitute a living wage for single adult households in any state. Rami Mazahari is in Chicago.
In his very first campaign speech to win the presidential election, Joe Biden promised to more than double the federal minimum wage from just over $7 an hour to a minimum of $15 per hour. However, the ruling Democratic Party has retracted the wage increase from the third fiscal stimulus negotiations, disappointing 30 million low-wage workers in the middle of a once-in-a-century economic crisis. There is a whopping 75% public approval rating for Biden's stimulus program, but those polls came out before many of the details were released. Biden has since pulled support for many of the economic promises he made during his election campaign. After just 1 month in office, Biden has so far backtracked on his promises for major student debt relief, the amount of and length of unemployment payments, the total amount of household stimulus checks, and he has made no mention of reversing Donald Trump's signature tax cuts for the rich, something that Biden promised to initiate on his very first day in office.
It really shows the bankruptcy of every 4 years, this incrementalism where the left in the United States is pressured into getting behind the Democratic candidate, not going third party. Why? Because, oh, well, we're going to get these small concessions, like something like, hey, a $15 minimum wage increase or student loan debt, things like that.
However, countless economists insist that a wage increase would stimulate the economy overall by giving workers more money to spend, thus creating jobs and badly needed growth.
By doing that, by saying that, you know, it's impacting small businesses, what they're effectively doing is taking the economic burden that's put on small businesses by corporations, which own and control the politicians in Washington, they're shifting that burden onto workers and making workers pay the price.
The so-called fight for $15 began shortly after 2009, which is the last year the federal minimum wage was increased. But a decade later, studies show that constant inflation means that $15 per hour in 2021 would not constitute a living wage for a single adult household in any state. The study said in the cheapest metropolitan areas, $20 per hour is now required, while major cities would need $25 per hour. Rami Mazahari, Chicago.
Now, UN human rights experts have warned that U.S. emergency declarations authorizing unilateral sanctions are leading to serious human rights violations. The experts said the bans violate a wide range of human rights, not only in targeted countries such as Iran, China, Russia, Syria, and Venezuela, but also elsewhere across the world. They added that coercive measures breach rights to freedom of movement and association, as well as economic and social rights and the very right to life. The UN experts stressed that U.S. emergencies often last years or even decades, and so do the sanctions they authorize. They noted that the declarations appear to be excuses to impose the measures indefinitely instead of being true emergencies. That brings an end to our bulletin for this hour. Thank you for staying tuned.
selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
It guides us through life. It has taught us everything. We should learn and appreciate what it gives us. And try to apply them to our daily lives. How is it possible? By means of Quran.
این خوندن قرآن و تلاوت قرآن قدم اول است برادران من، این قدم آخر نیست.
Reading and recitation of the Quran is the first step, brothers, not the last one.
هو الذي أرسل رسوله بالهدى ودين.
It is he who has sent his apostle with the guidance and the religion of truth, that he may make it prevail over all religions, though the polytheists should be averse.
والذي أرسل رسوله بالهدى ودين الحق ليظهره على الدين كله ولو كره المشركون.
تلاوت القرآن با صوت خوش، با آداب که شیوه خاصی دارد، موسیقی خاصی دارد، روش خاصی دارد، اینها چیزایی لازم نیست.
Recitation of the Quran in nice tones should be performed according to particular methods and tones.
اما این کافی نیست.
But it's not enough.
مشکل بزرگ مسلمانان دنیا دوری از قرآن. دوری از قرآن. از قرآن.
Muslim's major problem is losing touch with the Quran. 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 کتاب الله.
Path towards enlightenment.
In the name of God, the All Merciful, the All Compassionate. Salam and welcome to another episode of our weekly series titled Path Towards Enlightenment, which is an endeavor to make you and us familiar with an easy and fluent explanation of God's final scripture to all mankind, the Noble Quran, which was revealed to the last and greatest of all messengers, Prophet Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny. We start from where we left you last week, and here are ayahs 24 and 25 of Surah Ahqaf.
فَلَمَّا رَأَوْهُ عَارِضًا مُسْتَقْبِلَ أَوْدِيَتِهِمْ قَالُوا هَذَا عَارِضٌ مُمْطِرُنَا بَلْ هُوَ مَا اسْتَعْجَلْتُمْ بِهِ رِيحٌ فِيهَا عَذَابٌ أَلِيمٌ تدمر كل شيء بأمر ربها فأصبحوا لا يرى إلا مساكنهم كذلك نجزي القوم المجرمين.
When the disbelievers saw it as a cloud advancing toward their valleys, they said, "This cloud brings us rain. Rather, it is what you sought to hasten. A hurricane carrying a painful punishment." destroying everything by its Lord's command. So they became such that nothing could be seen except their dwellings. Thus do we requite the guilty lot. Recall last Friday, in our explanation of the previous ayahs of this surah, we said the ancient nation of Ad in southern Arabia had ridiculed Prophet Hud, who was raised among them by Almighty Allah, in order to guide them towards monotheism and virtue by warning them of the dire consequences of idol worship and indulgence in sins. Although some believed in him, the majority, misled by the arrogant elites of the society, scornfully told him that if he is really truthful, he should show some example of divine wrath, despite his saying that everything is in the power of Allah and he is only a guide towards divine mercy. Because of their disobedience, the All-Merciful decreed famine, and for 3 years, not a single drop of rain fell, in order to teach them a lesson. But the sinners and idol worshippers did not give up their evil ways. Thus, as is clear by the ayahs that we recited to you now, when their sins exceeded all limits, divine wrath came in the form of a dense cloud, which the idolaters thought was rain, but it turned out to be a terrible hurricane that was an answer to their scornful mocking of the words of guidance. In other words, it was the torment sought desirously and hastily by the arrogantly ignorant disbelievers. While Prophet Hud took away the believers to safety as the wind invigorated their bodies, this same wind struck the disbelievers with such a fury that it destroyed everything in its path. It blew for 7 days and nights, and when it subsided, their dead bodies had also disappeared. Since the wind pulled them out of their seemingly safe houses that were hewn out of mountains and hurled them all over the wilderness, smashing them to bits, it destroyed everything to the extent that nothing remained but their mountain dwellings in order to serve as a lesson for the coming generations. These ayahs teach us the following points. Number 1. Rejection of manifest truth out of arrogance and ignorance results in a terrible punishment. Number 2. The forces of nature, such as wind, clouds, rain, fire, mountains, and dunes, and all other phenomena, are controlled by the Almighty Creator, who can make them a blessing for the believers and a punishment for the disbelievers. And number 3, destruction of seemingly mighty nations because of their indulgence in disbelief and sins is a divine tradition, as could be observed by the ruins of the past civilizations in various lands. ولقد مكناهم في ماء مكناكم فيه وجعلنا لهم سمعا وأبصارا وأفئدة فما أغنى عنهم سمعهم ولا أبصارهم ولا أفئدتهم من شيء إذ كانوا يجحدون بآيات الله وحاق بهم ما كانوا به يستهزئون. certainly we had granted them power in respects that we had not granted you, and we had vested them with hearing and sight and hearts. But neither their hearing availed them, nor did their sight, nor their hearts, in any way when they used to belie the signs of Allah. So they were besieged by what they used to deride. This ayah is a warning to the polytheists and disbelievers of Mecca who used to mock the Prophet of Islam and deny his universal mission. It means to tell them that the ancient nation of Ad was physically and materially stronger than them, but could not escape divine wrath for its disobedience of divine commandments conveyed through prophethood. The Ad could have been saved from destruction had they used their God-given intellect and other facilities to recognize and accept the truth. They didn't, and suffered the consequences, since they misused their ears, eyes, and other bodily organs to indulge in sins by rejecting the manifest truth, by mocking prophethood, and daring to desire divine wrath, which ultimately besieged and annihilated them. In other words, as a consequence of their vices and rejection of truth, they suffered the torment and paid for their mockery. From this ayah we learn that, number one, power and wealth doesn't necessarily save a person or a nation from doom. When the God-given intellect and organs such as sight, speech, hearing, and heart's desire are misused to commit sins and turn away from the truth. And number two, it is a cardinal crime to ridicule the messengers of God and mockingly call for affliction from divine wrath. Now let us listen to Ayah 27 of Surah Ahqaf.
وَلَقَدْ أَهْلَكْنَا مَا حَوْلَكُمْ مِنَ الْقُرَى وَصَرَّفْنَا الْآيَاتِ لَعَلَّهُمْ يَرْجِعُونَ.
Certainly we destroyed towns that were around you, and we have paraphrased the signs so that they may come back. This ayah continues its message to the disbelievers of Mecca by drawing their attention to the destruction of the ancient towns and cities around them or near to them in order to awaken their conscience and save them from suffering a similar fate. As a matter of fact, all merciful God always shows his signs through the miracles performed by the prophets and the exemplary life they had. To be more precise, the signs of the Almighty Creator are all around us and in our own selves, so that we ponder upon them to recognize the truth of monotheism and virtue by abstaining from sins, idol worship, and all sorts of disbelief, irrespective of poverty and wealth, or comfort and hardship. God Almighty gives an ultimatum to humanity against denying the divine message, harming prophets and the faithful. Those who are heedless suffer a terrible fate so that others may take a lesson. This ayah teaches the following points. Number one, the Noble Quran as the revealed word of God Almighty invites mankind to study the history of past nations and ponder upon the fate that befell them, so that it serves as an admonition. And number two, the All-Merciful Lord has provided ample means of guidance for mankind, as well as the respite needed to repent and reform through seeking of forgiveness in the Divine Court. Thank you. Now let us listen to Ayah 28 of the same surah as the last one of this week's episode.
فلولا نصرهم الذين اتخذوا من دون الله قربانا آلهة بل ضلوا عنهم وذلك إفكهم وما كانوا يفترون.
So why did not those false gods help them whom they had taken? Besides Allah as gods, as means of proximity to Him, rather they forsook them. And that was their lie, and what they used to fabricate. This ayah is an admonition to the disbelievers and indicates that inclination toward proximity to the one and only God is part of innate human nature, which means even many idolaters regard their objects of worship as a means of nearness to God. We may rely on someone as a means of succor in hardships, but it would be wishful thinking to regard idols as a means of support in view of the abject helplessness of these lifeless objects. In other words, this ayah is a rejection of the claims of those entangled in torment because of polytheism and disbelief. They worship the statuses of what they called their deities, which were fashioned by their own hands, saying that these inanimate objects are among the means of achieving proximity to Almighty Allah. Once, however, divine wrath struck, the idols were abandoned because of acute inability to save their worshippers, thus exposing the lies and fabrications of the disbelievers. This ayah teaches us that, number one, it is ignorance and superstitious belief that makes people worship the objects crafted by their hands and the imagination of their warped minds. And number two, if a thing or a person is unable to save themselves for any torment, how can they save others and be the means of proximity to the one and only Creator?
The debate.
Hello and a warm welcome to the debate on Press TV. I'm your host, Behrouz Ajahi. Finally, the International Criminal Court has opened a formal investigation into crimes committed by Israel against Palestinians in the occupied territories. The ICC chief prosecutor has asserted the court will adopt a principled and nonpartisan approach. Palestinians have favored a move which they regard as a long-awaited step. Israel and its key supporter, the U.S., have strongly opposed this. The White House has stressed it will go on to uphold full commitment to Tel Aviv. Now, will the ICC be able to put an end to the impunity and bring the Israeli criminals to justice? We'll discuss those questions and similar issues after going to Ramallah to our correspondent, Mona Kandil there. Mona, tell us how the Palestinians feel about this.
Well, the Palestinians praised the move, and the Palestinian Authority urged world states to refrain from politicizing these independent proceedings, especially that the ICC announcement has angered both the United States and Israel, with Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu saying clearly that Israel is under attack today, and that the biased ICC in The Hague made a decision that is the essence of anti-Semitism and hypocrisy. So Palestinians today are very happy for this decision by the ICC, but at the same time, they are questioning that would the United States be allowing, of course, it has furiously condemned the court, would it be allowing the prosecution of Israeli officials and forces, especially that it immediately condemned the ICC? More of the Palestinians, of course, have demanded the International Criminal Court to look into crimes during the Israeli war in the Gaza Strip in 2014, as well as the ongoing Israeli settlement activity and expansion in the occupied West Bank and in Jerusalem. Al-Quds, the Palestinians also expressed their readiness to cooperate with the ICC with preparing numerous files that would be giving, let's say, would be helping the ICC to prosecute Israeli officials and military officials in the Israeli regime.
Okay, definitely. They have the footage of those protests and even targeting media people along with women and kids. Thank you for that. That was Mona Kandil telling us about how the Palestinians feel about this. Now, joining me in this debate show will be MEP with the Ireland South, Mick Wallace, is in Brussels. And we'll also have former UN rapporteur in the occupied territories, Richard Falk, who is joining us out of Yalıkavak, I believe. It must be in Turkey. Welcome to the show, both gentlemen. Now, let's go to Mick Wallace, Chief Prosecutor. Fasuda is speaking of having conducted a painstaking preliminary examination that lasted almost 5 years. And she's promised an independent, impartial, and objective investigation without fear or favor. Would that be possible?
It will be very difficult without fear or favor. I mean, she's already highlighted the fact that they're under-resourced, and listen, they find it difficult to operate, right? You, if you look at the history of the ICC, you will see that they struggle to get good results a lot of the time. And, you know, you have the very fact that the likes of the Americans and the Israelis don't even recognize it. I mean, is a problem, because obviously the U.S. and Israel think they're above international law. But it's a good move that this has happened. It's good that the ICC have gone to this space and addressed the issue. But I wouldn't be jumping up and down about the prospects of getting a great result. Now listen, it's not rocket science that the Israeli military forces in the West Bank and Gaza commit terrible war crimes on a daily basis. But for the ICC to come up with that, they're obliged to initially allow both sides, the Israeli side and the Palestinian side, to actually do their own investigations, and because that's part of the format. So what we're going to have now first is the Israeli government will actually be allowed to investigate allegations of criminal activity on the part of their military, mm-hmm. and that'll be a whitewash for sure, 100%. Right? That's guaranteed to be a whitewash. Now, how the ICC deal with that then remains to be seen. And it'll be very challenging for them. I'm not saying that we're not going to get a decent result out of it, but I'm just saying it's hard to be optimistic that we're going to get the full truth. There'll be serious opposition to this.
Okay.
Israel, US, don't want the truth told about what the Israel does to the Palestinians,
okay,
on a daily basis.
I'll come to those questions later on in the show. Now let me turn to Richard. Benjamin Netanyahu has called the probe an anti-Semitic attack. You know, whatever you talk about Israel, they call it anti-Semitic. Is this really anti-Semitic attack?
That's really an absurd and outrageous response to a judicial process that has leaned over backwards to be careful and judicial in the best sense. And it I think, expresses more than anything else the hopelessness of the Israeli position if one considers the substance of these allegations about minority in the occupied Palestinian territory. It is such a clear-cut set of facts backed by evidence, and the only recourse that Israel has is to denounce the institution and to act as if it's not accountable for any kind of violation of international law. And that's really very bad for, it's a bad precedent, it's irresponsible, but it's understandable because Israel has all along defied international international law, and it's had the geopolitical backing of the United States. Having said that, it's still a momentous decision if nothing else happens, because it legitimizes on the level of symbolic politics, which are very important in these struggles, the claims and the grievances that the Palestinian people have felt, and the very outrage that Netanyahu expresses is actually a confirmation of the weight of these grievances. And so the ICC has already done itself incredible positive credit by launching this investigation, even if no behavioral results in terms of indictments and convictions and punishments result from it.
Right. Now, Mick, ICC insists that it has reason to believe that Israeli authorities have committed war crimes. You know, it took them 5 years to do this preliminary probe, and on that basis they are making this a statement. Let's have your thoughts on that.
Yeah, I think Richard's point is a very strong one. Whatever comes out of this now, it's been something really positive that they've gone to this space at all. And I'm sure it wasn't easy for them. And I think it puts pressure on the EU in particular. Unfortunately, right, Israel does what it likes and totally disrespects international law on a regular basis because it can. And the reason it can, obviously, is because the US would allow them to do anything they want. And unfortunately as well, people need to take on board that the EU bears responsibility too. And I would argue that the complicity of the EU and the silence of the EU in the face of terrible atrocities being committed against the people of Palestine, the Palestinians in the West Bank, in Gaza, the people displaced outside the country in refugee camps and wherever, the treatment of those Palestinians is abysmal, and the EU bears responsibility for not standing up for the human rights of the Palestinians. They talk about human rights in areas where it's geopolitically suitable, but they ignore them a lot of the time where it doesn't suit the US. Because they have behaved for too long like a puppet of the US. Mm-hmm. And I would say that this decision by the ICC to go to this space is going to put extra pressure on the EU to actually face up to the truth and become more involved in addressing the plight of the Palestinian people.
Okay. Now, Richard, speaking of the U.S., so you know that Washington has expressed disappointment with and also opposition to this ICC move. And what does it mean? I mean, a crime is a crime, no matter who commits it, right?
It should be, but the geopolitical reality is that it's a crime if it's a weak state. It's if it's a strong state, there's no accountability unless it happens to lose a big war, as Germany and Japan did after World War II, and then there's some procedures of accountability for the losers. But the real message is there are double standards with respect to international criminal law. The weak can be held accountable, the strong and their friends are given impunity. And that's a sad and glaring weakness in the kind of world order that exists in the world today. And it's been so blatantly exposed in the way in which Israel has treated the Palestinian people now for decades. And the world watches, and I agree with what Mick said about the EU having complicity. There is no responsible reason for not backing the ICC in exercising its authority as it's vested in an international treaty. Mm-hmm. And if you read the documents that it has issued and the long preliminary investigation that it conducted, it's beyond reasonable doubt that there were crimes committed, that it is appropriate to hold Israel and Hamas. We haven't mentioned the fact that the ICC also is investigating crimes that are alleged to have been committed by Hamas in the form of using indiscriminate rockets in the 2014 skirmish with Israel. So that the undertaking is really the most dramatic and significant in the history of the International Criminal Court, and will bring, I think, great credit to it if it's able to persist at least to the extent that it won't give way to the kind of pressures that Israel, the United States, and maybe some other countries will exert.
Okay. Now, Mick, both of you referred to the EU as an accomplice to the U.S. in blind support for Israeli crimes. You're a member of the European Parliament. Tell our viewers what you or maybe your colleagues have done or planning to do regarding exposing the Israeli crimes within the European Parliament.
Well, for those of you that follow, I'm on the Foreign Affairs Committee. I'm also on Security and Defense. And a lot of the plenary sessions that are held once a month for a week cover foreign affairs matters. In fact, a huge chunk of the plenary is devoted to foreign affairs. I would ask people themselves to judge as to whether we're having an impact, but we're not afraid to speak out. We are not beholden to anybody. We fight for justice anywhere in the world, and we see it as our responsibility at all times, and without fear or favor. We're not pandering to an electorate, wondering, are we going to get elected the next time if we don't do this or we don't do that, or if we say this or we say that. We were in the Irish Parliament for 8.5 years, myself and Claire Daly, and we didn't pander to the electorate, but we still kept getting elected, and we got elected to the European Parliament. And obviously in the European Parliament, no one would be surprised to hear that at least 90% of the European Parliament, of the 705 MEPs, I would say 90% of them are of an Atlanticist nature, which is unfortunate. But I would also argue that while 90% of the members of the European Parliament we find ourselves in opposition to on a daily basis, I would argue that they don't fairly represent the citizens of Europe. There are 450 million people in Europe, and I would say the majority of them are completely in favour of the Palestinians
being treated in a fair manner, and then being put to what is a form of genocide against the Palestinian people by Israel for a long time now. That is not what the European people want. It might be what a lot of the politicians in the European Parliament sign up to, because they are in the pockets of lobbyists who have a vested interest in pushing them in a particular direction.
Okay. Now, Richard, how would Washington's all-out support for the Tel Aviv regime affect the tribunal's probe?
Well, of course, it's hard to tell. It has no legitimate basis for exerting influence whatsoever. The tribunal is supposed to operate as an independent international institution. The U.S. is not a party to the treaty constituting this international criminal court, and it really is obliged to act responsibly by allowing it to function in accordance with its own constitutional framework. And if it doesn't allow, there will be a civil society effect of this decision, which we shouldn't overlook. It will help things like the BDS campaign that has been trying to exert nonviolent pressure on the Israeli government to uphold international law and to acknowledge and address the grievances of the Palestinian people. And this decision, even if it doesn't result in any behavioral outcomes, will be a tremendous support, will lend tremendous support to the global solidarity movement that may in the end be the most significant outcome of what has happened so far.
Okay. And Mick, the ICC is also intending to probe Israel's 2014 war on Gaza, the illegal settlement activity, and also the deadly response to anti-occupation rallies that happened in 2018. How serious and what type of verdict would you issue for those crimes and illegal land grab?
Listen, that's kind of too easy a question in some ways. A big concern for me today is that international law is not being fully respected by the international community. And it's a sad time when we have the likes of the European Union introducing sanctions against countries like Iran, like Syria, Venezuela, Nicaragua, Cuba, you name it, introducing sanctions that are actually illegal. Sanctions are only illegal if they are backed up by a UN resolution. Most of the sanctions that have been applied today, and the Americans have sanctions against 38 countries, and very sadly, Europe supports a lot of them. But the demise of international law is really worrying. I'm not saying that it's going to continue, because I actually don't believe that the European Union can continue on this path of being a complete puppet to US imperialism. And I would like to think that we will get back to a point where the EU really does respect international law and holds the likes of the Israelis to account for atrocities that they commit against anybody.
Okay, thank you very much for your contribution. That's all the time we have. Let me thank our guests. We had the MEP of Ireland South, Mick Wallace, in Brussels, and former UN rapporteur in the occupied territories, Richard Falk, who joined us out of Jelenkovac. And that's it for this edition of The Debate.
Is there any other way to get familiar with Islam besides mainstream media? Try IRIB English Radio.